You found the Digging Oak Island podcast, a podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you guys so much for downloading and listening. If you've been listening to and enjoying our little podcast, please consider helping the show out by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggingoakisland to learn more. Right, I know that this podcast took a little bit longer to get out than it usually does. It was a lot going on in the professional life and all that kind of stuff this past week. So I also kind of wanted to collate some other emails and do some extra things. So it is the end of the season, and there is no rush to get anything going here because, you know, we don't have another episode we got to get in. So I kind of took my time, got it right, and thanks for your patience, and here we go. Again, folks, if you think this podcast is worth $5 a month to you, you'd like to see the podcast keep on going, please consider helping us out. You can become a patron of our show. It's $5 a month. You get exclusive access to a live chat during the Curse of Oak Island U.S. broadcast of each new episode. That chat is the best part of my week for sure. So come and join us. $5 a month. Cancel anytime. Patreon.com/diggingoakisland. Sign up. Support the podcast. Also, if you prefer not to do the monthly thing, you know, that makes all the sense in the world. You can make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use the username @DaveMcBrideMusic. I'm a musician by trade. That's my virtual tip jar there, so you can hit it that way. Thank you guys very much for doing that in the past. And again, if you want to show your support with a one-time donation, Venmo @DaveMcBrideMusic. Now, folks, this was the last episode of the season. And I think it's important that every year we kind of reflect on what you guys, the viewers of the show, the fans of the show, thought. So I would love to make the next episode all about your thoughts and emails about season 11. You could take this any way you like it. You want to talk just about what the TV was like, where, you know, what the shows were like, the pacing, what you liked, what you didn't like, you know, how you feel about where the search is going, all that kind of stuff. Take it any way you like. But let's make the next podcast kind of something that we would like the producers to use to truly gauge what their viewers think about what they just saw this season. The best way to do that is via email, diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Get them in soon so I can start pulling them together and recording the next show before we take a little bit of a break as I line up some interviews and stuff for the off season. And I got some great possibilities here, so stay tuned for all of that. All right. As always, let's start today's podcast with emails and messages from you guys, the listeners, and we begin with a quick one from our friend Steve, who just said, quote, "So now it's a Viking ship buried in the swamp." He also included a link to a monstersandcritics.com article, which puts two and two together, with Doug Kroll pointing out a part of a Viking ship the team was on during the, not this past episode, but the one before that, and how it looked a bit like a wood piece found in the swamp a couple of years back. Here is a quote from the article. It says, quote, "The guys have long suspected a ship lies buried in the swamp. They have often speculated that it could be a Spanish galleon, but perhaps Doug has now spotted evidence that it is a Viking ship." Steve, listen, I know I don't need to tell you this, not you personally, but maybe some others don't know this. The guys don't think there's a ship buried in the swamp. They no longer suspect that. That's because there was a ship-shaped anomaly that came out during the seismic testing. The guys drilled into it at great expense, by the way, and found out that the anomaly was nothing more than a patch of sand. You know, it's not a ship. And with all the digging and draining they've done in the swamp, if there were a ship in there, don't you think they might have come across it by now? I mean, instead, all they found are some wood scraps along the southern side of the swamp that used to be the beach. Makes all the sense in the world that that's where you would find such a thing in the North Atlantic. And how the Templars in 1307 could have come across a Viking ship centuries after the Viking era ended, I mean, you know, who knows? Thank you, as always, Steve. Great stuff. Let's go now to an email from our friend Rob, who writes, "Hey, Dave, this is Red. I'm sorry, I said Rob, I meant Red. This is Red in California. Your Pirates are in San Francisco this weekend. He's talking a couple of weekends ago. And I can't say I'm sorry about the walk-off last night, but I'm happy to say seeing your team prompted me to think more about something you said regarding Nolan's Cross. First, let me hold on, Red. All in all, the Pirates aren't doing too bad. We got a little patch of grass there that wasn't great, but we're hovering around 500. For a team with this low a budget and so many great pitchers on the horizon, I think that's kind of something to build on, right? Anyway, enough baseball. Back to the email. I think it's fair to say you are skeptical, and this is Red talking again, you're skeptical about the authenticity of Nolan's Cross and whether it was placed there by Fred. And although I haven't personally dived deep into Fred's history on the island, I was with you in the late and at least wondering about whether the cross was recently fabricated. And because the Fellowship basically ignored Nolan's Cross for 11 years, and Marty has often said he has his doubts about it, questioning the authenticity of Nolan's Cross is valid. All right, I got to kind of interject again here, Red. I am skeptical on the cross's authenticity for two main reasons. One is that I've spoken to a couple of people over the years who have actually been on the island and have concluded that it certainly can be a fabrication. Now, I'm not saying I 100% agree with their assessment, but it causes me at least to be skeptical of the cross, right? Also, Fred Nolan has a very guarded history of the way he's approached things and the way he's released things and, you know, has it leads you to be a little skeptical about that stuff. The other reason, the third reason, really, if I'm going to say it's three main reasons, is exactly what you say here. My initial skepticism is somewhat confirmed in my mind by how little attention the Laginas have ever paid to it over these years. I mean, hardly an episode goes by that doesn't mention Nolan's Cross, yet we have this thawing of the Nolan and, you know, the relationship between the Laginas, the Blankenships, and the Nolans, and nobody said the first thing we should do is check out Nolan's Cross. Seems a little weird to pay that little attention to it over the years. You know, we haven't seen so much as the team kind of look closely at many of these boulders, no less excavate them or examine them with an archaeologist for all these years. Why is that? But Red is about to get to something else here that I agree with that contradicts this skepticism just a bit, and something kind of new in my mind that is making me wobble on whether or not I am skeptical about it. So let me get back to the email, where Red writes, but since the archaeoastronomical theory was presented a couple of weeks ago, I'm leaning toward Nolan's being placed there by someone other than Fred Nolan. The academic discipline of archaeoastronomy is relatively new, and only since the 1960s has it really been taken seriously by mainstream archaeology. Fred was a professional surveyor, so he certainly could have accurately aligned the stones to whatever he wanted, but to line them up with the stars 700 years earlier would have required a basic understanding of archaeoastronomy and specific knowledge of the stars in the 13th century. Even if Fred was aware of and interested in archaeoastronomy, calculating the specific celestial alignment of the constellation to exactly what it was 700 years ago is not easily done without complex computations and computer power. Even if he had the desire and ability, why would Fred specifically pick the 13th century to fabricate the cross alignment? Doesn't add up to me. If Fred believed the swamp was man-made by persons from the pirate era some 500 years later, wouldn't he instead have lined up the cross to the constellations as it appeared in that period? Finally, if the cross was laid out without celestial alignment in mind at all, the placement is awfully coincidental to a historical time frame supported by other evidence found on the island. Thanks for your hard work. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to the final episode and Corian proclaim happy ending. Hopefully you are planning a talk with him for the podcast this summer, maybe even to discuss the Jerusalem files and allow questions from readers. That's a great idea. Keep on Bobby Dazzlin, Red. Okay, Red. Whether one believes in the archaeoastronomy alignment theory presented by Professor Gaspani, or, important to remember, the Versailles alignment theory presented by Corian Moll and Chris Morford, to say Nolan fabricated the cross using these alignments and then never offered up that theory himself, to me, you know what? You're right. That doesn't make a lot of sense. Why wouldn't he have said that? You know, geez, folks, look at this cross and holy schmoly, it aligns with the constellations or Versailles or whatever. Am I making sense? Now, could these alignments be a coincidence? Sure, we don't know how exact they are. We've never been showed that, right? So why not? I honestly don't know what the math is like on these theories, and we already, and could, if Fred had lined these up to the constellations that he saw then, how close would he have been if he had done that? Also, keep in mind, Fred was a proponent of the Templar theory. He did talk about that quite a bit. And if he fabricated it, and another thing, keep in mind also, we already have two very separate alignment theories. So, of course, there could be some coincidence in all this, right? Because there already has to be some coincidence in some of it. Unless we're saying the Templars aligned it to the star, and then so did the French king 300 years later align it to, you know, I mean, all of that's possible, but you start to see where the waters start to get muddy just a little bit, right? And if he fabricated it, I would think that Nolan would have to base it on something, right? So he had to have some reason to point the cross in the way he did and place the boulders at certain distances, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right, Red. These theories have placed something of a fly in the ointment for me. I'll say that. But as I've said many times, Gaspani's theory doesn't add up if you put it in historical context. He places these stars and the alignment that they used to line up these boulders in the 1200s. But the Templars were not fleeing Europe until a half a century later. Now, what's the difference? How far off would they be if they did this in 1320 or something like that, right? I mean, you see where I'm going. We don't know. We don't get this information. So it becomes next to impossible to really analyze it on our end. At the end of the day, I think without a full archaeological excavation of the boulders to determine the age and authenticity of Nolan's cross, this is going to remain at least something of a mystery. And maybe that's not a coincidence, right? I think that's the only way we get to the bottom of this. Anyway, thank you, Red. Let's go now to a listener named Ted who writes, "Hi, Dave. This is my first time emailing you, but I have been a longtime listener. I love your show. And whenever I have a question while watching the TV show and I think about sending you an email, inevitably you answer it on your next podcast. However, so far, I haven't heard anyone ask how strange it would be to get similar soil samples from the same general area. The Lot 5 samples and the Money Pit samples are from a relatively small area, and it seems a stretch that they get so excited that the samples are similar. If I were to dig a hole in my backyard and then go down the street and dig a hole in my neighbor's yard, would the soil samples really be that different? Thank you for your time. Keep up the good work. I look forward to your show as much or as more as I do for the TV show. Cheers, Ted." Ted, I'm not an expert on this, but I'm kind of with you in that skepticism, right? I honestly cannot understand why they're making such a huge deal about this. And I think I asked this last week, but I will do it again here. Tell me, if the people who dug the money pit and built the Lot 5 structure are the same people, why would they take soil from one to put in the other? What's the theory here? What's the practical application? I simply can't answer that. It seems way more likely to be what you say, especially considering the clay also found in the swamp. So we have dug out three spots pretty extensively, and they all have this clay. See where I'm going? Maybe there's more to this that we need to learn and that hasn't been shown to us, and maybe some of our listeners have something to add on this. I mean, I know there's a lot of people out there with a lot of expertise in that stuff. So what do you guys think? Is this really evidence of a connection between the two locations? It's a great question, Ted. I do hope we hear more about this in the future. And like I said, maybe one of our listeners can help us out. All right. We have a couple of long emails here, so let's get to them. Stay with me. We start with our old friend, Jock, who writes, "Hi, Dave. Hope all is well with you and your family, your new job, and your music business. I know your life as a podcaster is fantastic, as you are extremely good at this. Thank you very much. This is fun." Thank you, my friend. Anyway, he continues, "By the way, I do not watch the show anymore. Maybe this summer I might watch a few, but I end up yelling and swearing at the crazy comments, conjectures, and predictable characters. By the way, I do not swear at your podcast." Well, that's good. "The History Channel and Prometheus wants us to believe the Templars, with all their alleged treasure, had to leave Dodge to escape persecution. We tend to look at Europe in the 1300s with our 2024 eyes. 748 million people live there in 2020. I Googled what the population was in the Middle Ages. Wikipedia has a good summary. The Templars had that fatal day in 1307. According to Wikipedia, the population of Europe in 1300 was 79 million, 10% of what it used to be, or what it is now, I mean. This was hardly overpopulated, considering it is 10 times that today. It still might be considered frontier, with lots of woodlands and large estates owned by the friends with shovels of the knights. The Mediterranean would have been more populated, but England, Scotland and Ireland, and Scandinavian Iceland were off the beaten path, were not as populated. So why not bury these treasures in these countries? I should say, alleged treasures. No long, harsh Atlantic to cross. 3,000 miles from North Africa to North America. Why not Africa or Asia to bury these? As we all know, any fishing boat, community, harbor would have stories of lost souls in Atlantic storms. You are from Maine, and I expect there were horrific stories from 1700 to now about lives lost at sea. Back in those days, there were small sailboats building businesses with experimentation in boat design. Homemade boats, light little safety equipment, very few good charts, few lighthouses, no buoys, no radio, GPS communication, no helicopter rescues. The Atlantic is dangerous. See the map of Mahone Bay. Lots of islands to run into if you were asleep at the wheel. So if one is driving down to the harbor with an ox cart full of treasure, one would have to pick a nice sturdy boat with a captain with a long resume of successful deep ocean sailing, all with a semi-guarantee of getting my holy treasures to some unknown land only known to the Vikings. This secret place, with no known charts, would be somewhere to the west across that crazy, stormy Atlantic. Closer to travel if they left from Ireland. And after you deposit your treasure, you have to safely get back. Probably did not know about the Gulf Stream in the 1300s. I think the best way to get to North America was to go south to follow the wind and currents into the Caribbean first, or to get back from North America, right? See images of the trade winds in the Atlantic from Encyclopedia Britannica, which you can find anywhere, guys, just by looking it up. Vikings did not go that way, as they discovered Newfoundland by accident because of a storm. Didn't most people believe in a flat earth back then at the time of 80% of the people were illiterate? So no social media, newspapers, and information about the world that we have at our fingertips. The smuggling venture would be carefully planned. And one would be careful there were no spies for the church and also the governments, which would have followed the church's orders. The Knights Templar with red crosses on their tunics, riding horses and going from port to port looking for sailing passages would be a scene from a Monty Python movie. Yes, it really would. Once they have secured passage, how would you smuggle on board hoards of gold, treasure, and religious artifacts without the people at the dock area, sailors, tavern goers, tattoo artists, tourist shops, and others seeing them hauling these treasures? Gold is very heavy. Lots of armed guards would signal valuables. Once the ship got underway, and if one of the sailors snuck down below and discovered gold, would that not be a good reason to start a mutiny? Would need lots of guards on board. I guess the Spanish treasure-laden ship survived mutinies, not storms, so not totally impossible. The scenario of Vikings, Templars sailing and burying treasure is so totally far-fetched and preposterous, but anything to sell History Channel's audience. I've taken a bathymetric chart and created a paleo shorelines and applied the Gordon Fader sea level drop. The red line signifies a 2-meter drop. I think Fader is talking about 25 centimeters per century, or 1 meter for every 400 years, which takes us to 2 meters and gets us to 1300. So as your other friend of your show suggests, it does not require us to go too far back in time before Oak Island is called Oak Peninsula. Low tide would make it more accessible from the mainland. What is so special about that? A mystery? Why that place in all of Mahone Bay? All the best, Jock. Jock, you always have a great way of writing things, and I really do appreciate that about your emails. You ask some great questions, and ones I think that have to be asked, right? Listen, there is a reason you see Rick and Marty are actually kind of cool on the Templar theory, because it is pretty far-fetched. However, it's also possible. There's no doubt about that. And sure, the show leans to it's kind of a little too heavy into for what are obvious reasons, rating reasons into this, but there are a lot of smart folks out there, much smarter than me, who have been digging into this and even coming out with some information that makes you scratch your head a bit. So with that in mind, here's another email from our friend David. He is the author of a book, Oak Island Mystery Trees, among others. And you can read a lot about his research on his website, oakislandmysterytrees.com. We talked with David before, and I'm hoping to get him on the podcast during the off season, but he sent us another long email this week that I think you guys in particular, Jock, might find interesting. He writes, "Hello, David. With the release of Scott Walter and Donald Ross and Corey Amall and Chris Morford's books, I have finished my forensic research, Volume 3, and will publish in May. As you may have seen, I published 23 determinations using the forensic scientific method modality to trace the fiber from Oak Island back to the Levant, circa 1185 to 1330. These determinations show that it was not coconut fiber found on Oak Island, nor fiber from other palms, but the Judean date palm tree, which only grew in the Levant up through the same period. Another determination proves the Knights Templar had easy access to the necessary volumes of date palm fiber, which were eventually found on the island. Mole and Morford's book, The Jerusalem Files, helped my presentation that the menorah has historical linkage to the date palm tree worship started in ancient pre-dynastic Egypt, though that was not their intention. The fiber was then hitched a ride as packing material, along with iconographic relics, by the Knights Templar from the Temple Mount to eventually being stored in Scotland. Walter and Ra's new book, Oak Island Knights Templar and the Holy Grail, provide proof of timing of the movement of items from Scotland to Oak Island and then off Oak Island. These two books confirm their research and ours that, A, the date palm fiber had to have moved with the Temple Mount relics as the date palm tree had completely extirpated by the early 1400s, and by the 1300s, the Levant plantations in Jericho, Dead Sea, and Jordan River Valley, had more or less gone feral from neglect, and Phoenician culture ended. B, there was no access to those who moved such relics in 1395 from Scotland to Oak Island to have had any access to or been capable of acquiring date palm fiber from the Levant as it had died off. C, nor gained access to coconut fiber from anywhere outside the western coast of India, as coconuts had yet migrated into the Atlantic Ocean. Nor from the Pacific Ocean by that time, there is no archaeobotanical evidence that either coconut palms, nor coconut core fiber was ever introduced into the Fertile Crescent region at any time before or up through 1500 AD, when Alfonso Albuquerque became the first Occidental to acquire tons of core fiber. The mycology report in our first volume confirms the rate of rot of oak logs. Had they been in a money pit environment, would be close to 70% rotted by 1795 and had been cut and used in 1375. Therefore, if used for platforms in 1395 AD, there would have been still viable for a platform in 1795 when they were found. It is believed by experts that after 70% of the fiber mass has been decomposed, the logs would fail to support the load of disturbed soil refilled atop of them. This would have caused a cascading effect from the top down, as the top three platforms would have been the only logs to have rotted, not logs deeper in the money pit. But both the illustrations of Samuel D. Champlain of three date palms in Canada circa 1615 and Walter's new book, which provides a schematic of the underground operation on Oak Island, indicate there are three entrances into underground complex on Oak Island. The third unfound entrance is shown to be located on the top of the eastern drumlin. It is the entrance which depicts a hoisting system and also depicts a valve system somewhere in the funnel complex. I suspect this entrance, when found, will also have date palm fiber in it in the entry, and would thus mean the volume of date palm fiber which had been excavated in total would exceed the 1.54 metric tons already calculated in the money pit infiltration system and may reach 2 metric tons. I've traced the pagan deity status of the date palm tree from early pre-dynasty Egypt up through Assyrian, Babylonian, and Hebrew periods. And it spread as a sacred tree into those three major religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Furthermore, through the mysticism of Gnostic, Kabbalah, and Sufi symbology, the date palm tree formed the original tree of life motif until eventually it was replaced with indigenous trees from where the religious practices spread. This includes where the menorah's original design, when inspired from the date palm tree, both when the menorah branches were straight originally and when they surprisingly curved in around 81 to 83 AD. Though supposition, I believe the date palm fiber was used as packing material, as it was free, easily attainable in great quantities, and from secure locations controlled by the Templars, both through the palm plantations east of Acre or shipped out via the Dead Sea through Jericho plantations. Unlike the readily available papyrus, cotton, sugarcane as packing material, the date palm provided the symbolic protection of the sacred cargo. Once on Oak Island, when the entrances were being closed or somewhere within their construct, the fiber was presented again in a symbolic manner of protection. The protection was in conjunction with the megalithic tree of life and the meaning of the menorah and its symbology. In my research, from all others, there has not been provided an explainable function of the fiber on Oak Island. It is not a filtration medium in the filter system, as the eelgrass provided that function. Yet it was atop the eelgrass and below the 3 foot of beach sand. It would not have been placed in either the finger drains nor the flood tunnel itself, as it would have eventually acted like a clogging mesh. Also, the commentary tells us that under the coconut fiber and eelgrass, the small stones were found with no sand, dirt, or debris. Therefore, fiber in those other constructs would have been problematic, not supportive. Nor was there any apparent function of the fiber's application on the sixth platform, which was said to be above the level, which most likely had puddled clay acting as a siphon seal. No conceivable source of water from above, nor need for a filter at that level, the fiber placement there only makes sense symbolically. The Templars were big into symbology. This third volume investigates this single true evidentiary artifact, providing man-made constructs with Oak Island and also the largest artifact to date. Love to hear your thoughts, David. So, guys, there's a lot in there. It's very, very dense. I can't decide whether or not these palms are date palms or coconut. I have no idea. I've never seen them. I can only go with what the experts are saying. But what you got there between those two folks are two very smart guys concluding two very different things from the information available to them. David's research is fascinating, I'll admit, a bit over my head. But you can see where this is leading, right? He is onto a fiber here on the island that dates to way before the European Age of Exploration and lines up well with the Templar theories. But again, my hope for this summer is to have a few of these discussions in a lot more depth with these people who I consider experts. David, I wish I can say more on that. I've got to learn a lot more about what you're talking about and kind of be able to follow the whole thing to the end. But folks, I want you to check out his books and his website. He's got a lot of free information right there on the site. And I read that email because I know there's a lot of people out there who are really into this stuff and probably find that really interesting. And I think I found it really interesting too. I know a lot of you find this angle cool, you know, so have at it. Take a look at what he's writing and what his theory is, and let me know what you think. All right, that's all for the emails today. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments, send them along to digginoakisland@gmail.com. All right, it's time now to discuss season 11, the season finale. Called episode 25, I think, right? Called Worth the Wait. Wait spelled W-E-I-G-H-T. Get it? Isn't that funny? Anyway, let me say this right off the top, because I know a lot of people get on my case about complaining and not liking things and maybe being negative or whatever it is that they accuse me of. I own it all. It's fine. I'm fine with that. But the consensus on the live chat was one of disappointment in the finale. And I really have to agree with that. After a season that included some really fantastic episodes in my mind. I mean, I love this. This one was really a great season. But this finale was nothing more than a glorified sort of season recap show. And for those, again, who complain about how the show spends too much time on old information and footage, this episode was that concept on steroids. Just in the first 11 minutes of the show, there was honestly hardly more than maybe 3 minutes of new content. And the reason why this bugs me is because next week there's going to be a drilling down episode called Zeroing In, where they're going to do exactly this again. They're going to review the season. I don't see the reason for all this recapping, but that's where we are here. And so anyway, that criticism, if that's what you want to call it, will prove out again in this episode review, as there really wasn't a whole lot to talk about here on the podcast that we haven't already discussed in depth earlier this season. So we'll start at the Money Pit, where we see the team closing out the season's drilling project with a hole called E.5-N.14, which Marty called, quote unquote, one big swing. And that is one big swing to find the source of the precious metal in the water testing. Later, that borehole comes up empty, nothing but dry sand, in what felt like an attempt to sort of rescue a year of nothing but disappointment at the Money Pit. The guys start speculating about how the dryness of this sand means there really isn't water down there to flood the garden shaft like natural water, offering this as proof that this must mean there's a booby trap flood tunnel theory. Listen, I'm no expert. I don't think that's how underground water works, but Marty Lagina wouldn't know much better than I would, I guess, and thus we see the end of this year's work in the Money Pit. Next, we head to Lot 10, which contains one of the boulders of Nolan's Cross, only we aren't actually here to examine the cross. Instead, we see dozens and dozens of those little pink marker flags marking metal hits from when Gary Drayton had previously detected the area and identified targets with his detector. So what we see now is Gary, and I think Alex Lagina it was, right, are over there to start digging up these hits. And despite the dozens and dozens of flags all over the lot that we see, the only thing apparently worth discussing and showing us was a metal spike, which Gary says could be a chisel. I don't know about that, but I don't see much difference between this and the other spikes that we've seen. There was no expert there to agree with that assessment. And we know Gary's been wrong before about these things jumping the gun. He could be right. I have no idea. But either way, the narration then goes off suggesting how this could be the chisel that made the 90-foot stone or the HO stone. Guys, there's no reason to discuss that much any further, right? Next, we go to Lot 5. We see archaeologists Laird Niven and Helen Sheldon. They are continuing their excavation of the foundation. Last week, if you recall, they found what they thought was a small lead trade weight, they called, one used for a measuring of precious metals, coins, those kinds of things, right on a scale. This week, they find two more of them, and apparently the weights of each one of them kind of matches. And I think it was Helen who called them, quote, three of the same things we've never seen before, end quote. It's interesting for sure, but what does it mean? Steve on the Patreon remarked, quote, with the trade weights, maybe Oak Island was just a gold camp in support of local mining. Bring your dust and nuggets, we'll weigh and pay. I mean, Steve, honestly, so far, that's the only theory I've heard that makes any sense, because really, what is the team trying to say here? That the Templar Vikings came here and weighed the Ark of the Covenant with little ounce stones before burying it in a 100-foot deep hole? It doesn't make really a lot of sense. These features on Lot 5 are fascinating, which we'll get to at the end. But so far, I haven't seen anything here that makes me think that it has anything in particular to do with the treasure, the Vikings, or the Knights Templar, whoever. Not yet, right? Now, later in the episode, we get an examination in the lab of an arrowhead found. The guys have been talking about this for the last few weeks. It was found by Robert Dunfield back in the 1960s. If you recall, a couple of weeks ago, the team showed this item to a curator of the Ladby Viking Museum in Denmark, who said it was something of an something an archaeologist could find every day there, and very much thought it could be Viking in origin. Well, in this scene, we get to see why just showing an item to an expert is not really always enough to confirm something's origins, because Emma Culligan's scans of the metal makeup of the arrowhead show it to be pre-1600, and also English in origin. Now the team goes on to discuss how this doesn't preclude it from being Viking or Norse, but you see what I mean, right? The question I have is, does the chemical makeup mean it could be from any time before 1600? We can't zero that in at all. But again, as Laird himself says, that doesn't prove it isn't Norse, but it also doesn't prove it is. And while I know the Vikings spent time in England, which they like to talk about, do we know for sure they mined and produced armaments there for the expeditions? I don't know. Can anybody look into that? Because I don't think there was a whole lot of discussion about that. All right, let's take a quick break here. I know that's been a fast one, but let's take a quick break and come back and talk about the War Room wrap-up meeting. All right. Finally, the season ends, as it always does, in the war room as the team heads there for their yearly debrief. Before many of them head back to Michigan, back to the States, they begin with discussing Lot 5, which I think is the most fascinating part of Season 11. But here they talk instead about this imagined connection between the Money Pit and the Lot 5, rather than talking about the dates and what they think this might all mean after a full summer of excavation and analysis. You know, we didn't get that. We just got this thing about this potential connection, which I don't think they've really established. Anyway, next, the conversation turns to the swamp, where they talk only about the giant boulder they like to say looks like one of Nolan's Cross boulders. I find that line of thinking interesting, since its location certainly doesn't support it being part of the cross, but instead kind of gives us more evidence that there are, in fact, a lot of boulders this size all over the island. Anyway, they apparently carbon dated some sticks under the boulder, which is their method of dating when the boulder arrived at its location. The question I have now is, do you guys remember them lifting this boulder out of the ground to find sticks? Because I don't remember that. But my memory's terrible, so what do I know? The carbon dating on the sticks comes back with two ranges, 656 to 703 AD and 740 to 774 AD. Now, the editing here is really, really choppy, but even so, I can't figure why the team would be so happy about these dates. Again, I turned to Steve on the live chat in the Patreon, who said, why do they seem so excited whenever the dates are all over the place? I'd rather hear C-14 results of 1705, 1685, 1725, 1710. They seem to grin every time their window expands by another 100 years. Earliest Viking activity, I think, is something like 800 AD. Exactly who do they think was there pre-800? First Nations, Proto-Vikings, or Phoenicians? I think you said it perfectly there, Steve. I just don't know why these dates are good, and maybe you would have thrown in if it came back as it was moved there in 1350. You'd have something, right? Because then you have some carbon dating that goes with the idea that the cross was fabricated by the Templars when they got there. This pretty much tells us that, at least with this stone, it wasn't. So we can just throw this one away. But they never want to talk about it like that, right? They never want to say it like that. But that's exactly what I think it means. Anyway, next, the team is joined via video conference by Emiliano Sacchetti and Corey and Maul for just some recapping of the European trip. Nothing new at all there. And then they're followed by the scientists, who are all part of this precious metals and the Money Pit water investigation, coming. They actually come into the war room to chat. It seems from the conversation that there has been more testing done, and they still feel whatever is causing these levels is down there in the Money Pit and has not been removed. So the team decides next year they're going to drill much further north in the Money Pit. At one point, Dr. Matt Lukeman actually says he thinks it's very interesting that Aladdin's Cross, and they'd like to examine it, but we aren't given any reason why he thinks that. From what we saw, it doesn't seem very interesting to me at all. And in that same vein, Craig says that he feels that all in all, it was a good year. And again, it's hard to know exactly why he thinks that. Could be another editing thing, but who knows? Because in my mind, it's another year gone by here with no answers on these gold levels. And with that, we get a great scene with Rick, getting all nostalgic and crying. We truly love him for that. And then the episode and the season 11 all comes to an end. So what did I think of the season? Listen, I'm not trying to be a downer here, but if we're looking at this from a purely team treasure hunting perspective and not from a television perspective, I can't remember a worse year for them. Can you? They put a small fortune into the Garden Shaft and another small fortune into the Sonic Drilling Project, meant to find what they thought was the most exciting thing, the source of the precious metals in the water. And both of those projects came up empty, swings and misses. And the Garden Shaft was nothing short of a total disaster for everyone involved. Remember how excited they were about both of these things at the start of the year, how excited they were to find the source of the metal, to be able to get underground in the Money Pit. They were going to explore around there like never before, and thought they were going to find what they called a Billy Gerhardt dump truck full of gold somewhere down there underground. They found neither. And now they face a very real prospect of the Garden Shaft being almost unexplorable from this point forward if they can't figure out what to do. Add to that very little found in the swamp and this ever-expanding timeline that we keep talking about, and this season was just a lot of really expensive work with few tangible results. I mean, we went from talking about William Phipps and how he could have brought this stuff here and finding out the dates that the things that match to William Phipps to talking about the Vikings all in one season. If you're investigating lost history, that's not how you want this to go, not by any means. To me, the only real positive of the season, from their point of view, were the foundation features on Lot 5. It could very, very well turn out that these features have nothing to do with the story here, and both of these could easily disappear from our TV screens, just like the Samuel Ball homestead did a couple years ago. But either way, what we have here is the foundation of a structure, one that appears to predate the dividing of the island into lots, so predate 1760s, and a structure whose existence has been completely lost to history. And that alone is enough to fascinate me, and certainly Laird Niven as well. I just hope this archaeological work continues on into future seasons. Now, if we look at this from a purely television viewer perspective, I thought the season was really pretty good. It had some great episodes, some amazing drama when it comes to the Garden Shaft, and a terrific trip to Europe. You know, I really did love it. I really did. Much more so than a couple of the recent seasons. But it is hard to ignore what a rough year it was for those who worked so hard to try to get answers here. My biggest wish is that the producers would lean more into that and not be afraid of showing us what a difficult, near impossible task it is for these guys who we've grown to love to hunt for treasure on Oak Island, and how impossible that task has been for hundreds of years. When we get right down to it, to me, that is the real story of Oak Island, and trying to convince us that somehow every year they're getting closer and closer is starting to feel like a fool's errand, right? And it's starting to wear thin on viewers. Anyway, folks, remember, I want to know what you thought of season 11, and I want to do a podcast, kind of a little reference for all of the producers and showrunners to listen to what their viewers, their loyal viewers, think. And I want you to do that by sending it to me, diggingoakisland@gmail.com, so I can read it and talk about it on a future episode. That is going to do it for this episode of the Diggin' Oak Island podcast. Don't forget, you could really keep the show going by becoming a patron. If you think the show is worth $5 a month to you, then head over to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to learn more. And if you prefer, you can also make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use the username @DaveMcBrideMusic. If you want to help out the podcast in another way, then do so by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your shows. Thanks to everyone who's done that. And also, don't forget to follow us on Facebook. Just put in @DiggingOak Island into your search bar. And if you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Now, folks, I am going to be more sporadic with the podcast from now on, so just stay subscribed, check your feeds. It's not going to be weekly. Might be a couple of months, or we'll see how it goes. I'm going to spend a lot of time sort of doing some research to try to get some cool stuff for summertime podcasts, but I am also in need of a little bit of a break after 25 weeks, so it's going to be a little more sporadic, and I can tell you, after 25 weeks of this show, it is for sure crown time. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Diggin' Oak Island.